thanks very much to Sarah and to Ash for organising this process. I'm going to talk about primordial black holes, which are one of my lifelong interests, and in particular cosmological constraints. I gather everyone's here a cosmologist, if I understand correctly, so I can assume that it's understood about cosmology. What's interesting about primordial black holes, the black holes that form in the early universe, is that they are a really useful probe of all sorts of aspects of astrophysics. In particular, they're a probe of the early universe, because they form in the early universe. They're a sort of unique probe of any inhomogeneities, phase transitions, in particular, of course, inflation and non-Gaussianity and things like that. They're also a probe of high-energy physics, particularly the ones which are small enough to evaporate. If we ever detect a black hole evaporation, which we haven't unambiguously done yet, then looking at a black hole explosion and looking at cosmic rays and looking to see whether they form photospheres.
So you're saying you're ambiguous to have detected black hole evaporation?
Well, I mean, some people claim that some gamma ray bursts are primordial black hole explosions, but I would say that's very tentative, okay? So we cannot be sure that swirling black holes would be. I mean, if they were ever definitively discovered, that of course would be, wonderful. The third probe is the probe of what I call the dark side. Black holes, primordial black holes, are possible dark matter candidates. They could be relevant to dark energy. They could accrete dark energy and quintessence, for example, and also in particular, they could be probes of higher dimensions, and that's something I want to, or dark dimensions, which is something I want to focus on in this talk. I should say that this title is taken from a recent paper which I've did in collaboration with my Japanese collaborators, Kori Sendudo and Yokohama, which is, it's just come out, that's the Astro PH reference, and it's just appeared last month in PhysRevD. So there's a lot of details in the paper, which I'll only go over rather briefly here. Now, let me start off just by giving some general introductory remarks about primordial black holes. Is this a pointer or a crowd control? Right. So everybody knows, of course, the Schwarzschild radius just seems like the mass, so the density required in order for a mass m to collapse the black hole is goes like 1 over n squared. And of course, we know that there are black holes, stellar black holes, which are 10 solar masses. We also think there are these supermassive black holes, up to a billion solar masses in the centers of galaxies. But if you want to form a black hole smaller than a solar mass, you can really only do it in the early universe. And that's because you can see that the smaller the mass, the higher the density you need. But of course, in the early universe, the density can be arbitrarily high, and therefore you can form black holes of arbitrarily small mass. If you take the cosmological density in the Friedman model, it just goes like 1 over t squared. And so, by simply comparing that density to that density, you can immediately see that the mass of a black hole, which forms at some time t after the Big Bang, is essentially just the horizon mass. Or the Hubble mass, to be more precise, because obviously if you've got inflation, you have to be careful about what you mean by that.
Sorry, Bruno, I think there's something wrong with that.
The problem is it attaches the wrong way.
Actually, I'm taking my jacket off. Can I do that?
Yeah.
Because it's really hot.
But
then I can put this
in. Yes, that's
weird. Oh, no, is that better?
No, I think that's
right. So, the mass which forms at time t is the horizon mass, and you can immediately see from that that they can have a huge range of masses. The minimum mass is, this is the point, yeah, the minimum mass, very heavy pointer, but anyway, the minimum mass is essentially the Planck mass. If a black hole forms at the Planck time, which is the earliest time we're going to believe relativity, it has the Planck mass. On the other hand, if a black hole is forming, say, at 1 second, which is sort of, it's 10 to the minus 5 seconds, which is the QCD phase transition, which is probably round about the latest time PBH would form under normal circumstances, they would have a mass of something like 1 solar mass. So you've got this huge range of mass scales, which is what makes them interesting. A particularly interesting mass scale is associated with the black holes that form at 10 to the minus 23 seconds. They have got a mass of 10 to the 15 grams, and as I'm sure you know, that's the magic mass of the black holes which are evaporating today as a result of Hawking radiation. But I have to say that this mass range is a little bit simplistic. For example, if you believe that you've got extra dimensions which are extended, then if you have this, for example, a TV quantum gravity scenario, this minimum mass goes all the way up to something, well, it goes way beyond the normal planet mass. So the minimum mass could be much bigger than that, which is interesting because that's the circumstance under which you will form these black holes in colliders. On the other hand, there are some circumstances in which your maximum mass can be much bigger than that. If you invoke a double inflationary scenario, for example, or collapse of the main walls, you can form primordial black holes, which are much bigger than this. They can, in fact, be bigger than the sort of standard Friedman horizon mass. And that's interesting for people who want to use big black holes to do interesting astrophysical things, like you do in that.
So you're saying black holes are bigger than horizon? Or?
Well, they're comparable to the horizon mass. I mean, naturally speaking, their mass will be of order of horizon mass.
But even in some scenario, you said it could be bigger?
The point is this, that what I'm writing down here is the Hubble mass, essentially. Mm-hmm. If you have an inflationary scenario, obviously the causal mass can be bigger than that. It can be bigger than the Hubble mass. So. That's why I refer to the second inflationary sort of scenario, because sometimes you talk about, some people like to evoke 100 solar mass black holes, for example, primordial black holes, and normally that involves some rather exotic inflationary scenario. Mm-hmm. But in the simplest situation, this is the sort of mass change we expect. But of course, the other interesting thing about primordial black holes is that they evaporate. This is the famous Hawking formula. The temperature goes like 1 over the mass, and that means that the black hole evaporates on a time scale which goes like a cube of the mass. For solar mass, this is only about a millionth of a degree, and this is 10 to the 64 years. But, as I indicated a moment ago, if you have a 10 to the 15 gram black hole, which is a massive mountain, but just the size of a proton, that will be exploding today, that's to say it will be completing its evaporation today. If I put 10 to 15 grams there, I get 10 to the 10th years. And the final evaporation process would be an explosion, because obviously as the mass goes down, the temperature goes up. So it culminates in an explosion in which you get to release something like 10 to the 30 years. Now actually, that's bad news, because even when Stephen had this result in 75, he knew that there were constraints on the gamma ray background at 100 MeV, which immediately told us there can't be many black holes in that mass range. This is because a 10 to the 15 gram black hole is mainly sizzling away and producing 100 MeV gamma rays. And already, even in those days, the gamma ray background said that this is the density parameter of the black holes in units of the critical density. This has to be less than 10 to the minus 8. And that was bad news, because it really seems to suggest that you couldn't detect these black hole explosions. Now, I'll come back to that, because I already indicated in an earlier reply that there are some scenarios where you might conceivably detect black hole explosions. But at least at that stage, it looked pretty grim. Nevertheless, it was a tremendously exciting result, as I'm sure you all appreciate. The prediction of black hole radiation, It was unification of quantum mechanics and thermodynamics and general relativity, and I think most people accept it's one of the most important results in physics, really, in the last 50 years, even if primordial black holes don't exist. But of course, Stephen only started thinking about the quantum properties of these black holes because he realized that primordial black holes would be small. And so it's an example of that something can be interesting to think about, even if it doesn't exist, because it can lead to an interesting insight. Obviously, I like to think, because I've devoted my life to them, that they might exist. But even if they don't, it's been useful to think about. Now, this is my favorite photograph, and I can just be a little bit self-centered for a moment. When Stephen's first seminar on black hole radiance was given at Caltech in 1975, and Feynman was in the audience, and he liked to draw portraits, and I learnt after the seminar. I used to stand at the front when Stephen gave a seminar, he's a PhD student, translate for him. And someone said, oh, well, Feynman drew your picture. So I contacted his secretary, and he'd thrown away the envelope, but I retrieved it. So this is my favourite possession, really, in physics. It's just Feynman's notes on Stephen's lecture with my picture in the middle. I have never told this to Stephen, because Stephen would be very annoyed, because it sort of suggests that Feynman wasn't focusing entirely on the lecture, but he could think of many things at the same time. I like this because this picture was taken just a few weeks after I grew my beard. And I got rid of my beard just a month ago, after 35 years. So I've changed with the equations. Now, let me just, again, without being too technical, let me just say a little bit about how primordial black holes form. The most straightforward picture, because I told you that if they get a form, they can in principle form in the early universe because the density gets so high. But they don't necessarily form if you have a perfectly uniform Friedman background, you won't form black holes. One way is to say you've got inhomogeneities. If you've got density perturbations, the density perturbations will stop expanding and recollapse. Because of the radiation pressure, they have to be, it's hard for them to recollapse, but they can do under certain circumstances. So the most natural way to form primordial black holes is to have the non-linear inhomogeneities at early times. An obvious example of that is inflation, because every inflationary scenario will predict density perturbations. That's one of the great attractions of inflation. But those inflationary perturbations, will in certain circumstances generate primordial black holes. So you get strong constraints on primordial black holes, sorry, on inflationary scenarios, merely by the requirement that they don't overproduce primordial black holes. Sometimes in the history of the universe, you can have the pressure may reduce at some phase. Most of your energy may go into non-relativistic particles, for example, at the QCD phase transition at 10 to minus 5 seconds. And if ever there's a reduction in pressure, that means that primordial black holes can form quite easily. You can form bubbles of broken symmetry, and the bubbles can collide, and under certain circumstances, the bubble collisions will make primordial black holes. Cosmic strings used to be all the rage in cosmology, and the idea is if you have cosmic strings, they can form loops, and under certain circumstances, those loops will collapse to form primordial black holes. With a low probability, all of these things occur with a low probability, but as you'll see, you only need a low probability to.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
So, what is the latest on these string loops, that can they actually form a black hole?
Well, it depends essentially on the string parameter, which is normally called mu. And certainly, the mu is could in principle be big enough to make primordial black holes. But the question is the value of mu required to make primordial black holes going to be inconsistent with other observations? For example, you might make too many gravitational waves and things
but
like
there
that.
Are constraints on mu. Like
oh, yes, there are plenty of constraints on mu from gravitational wave backgrounds.
Yeah,
example,
and given those constraints, then can you
It depends what you, if you assume it's scaling vertically, because there's a mass range involved here, and the mass range for the black holes are on quite a small mass range, the gravitational waves are on a larger scale. So it depends what you assume about the if mu is scale invariant, which it is in the most straightforward string pictures. But actually, it's pretty marginal. That we always used to say, I mean, people haven't looked at cosmic black holes and cosmic strings for quite a while, but when it was last looked at, it was argued that the primordial black hole constraints were marginally stronger than the gravitational wave backgrounds. So it's they're pretty comparable. And people aren't so interested in cosmic strings now, but they're still in principle. That shouldn't exist in some scenarios. String necklaces, I have a PhD student who's working on this particular scenario for PVHs. And then the collapse of domain walls. If you have domain walls, as opposed to strings or loops, the domain walls can collapse, and that's one scenario which gives you really big black holes. Now, there's a huge literature on all of these topics, and all I can suggest is that if you read this review I mentioned, this long paper. It's got lots of references. I mean, there's 100. Well, I mean, there's probably about 50 papers just on PBHs and inflation alone. But then, why are PBHs interesting? Well, and the other thing I should say is that any constraints you have on the number of black holes is then going to be a constraint on all of these cosmological scenarios. So I'll get constraints on inflationary scenarios, bubble formation, cosmic strings, domain walls, from the fact that I mustn't make too many primordial black holes. And so that's one of the interesting things about primordial black holes. Even if you don't see them, you're going to get interesting constraints on the early universe. What do PBHs do? Again, I'm just going to talk in very common terms at this point. I mentioned they do a very useful probes, writing my first transparency, but it'd be a little bit more precise. The ones of the Planck mass, the smallest ones, essentially probe fundamental physics. For example, it's possible that Hawking evaporation will leave a stable Planck mass relic. And in that case, they will be interested in dark matter candidates. If you believe in extra dimensions, then it's natural that the smallest black holes, the ones that form at the earliest time, will be higher dimensional. And that will affect their signature or evaporation and things like that. In particular, that's a feature of brain cosmology. As I mentioned before, if you're interested in TV quantum gravity, the Planck mass is actually much bigger than that in some sense. And then you may actually detect these things in accelerators. And we'll say something about that. The ones which are less than 10 to the 15 grams, they're the ones, remember, which have already evaporated. And they do all sorts of interesting things. In particular, they tend to mess up the standard Big Bang scenario. We know the Big Bang picture is a triumph of fits the data, but many aspects of that picture would be ruined if you have too many primordial black holes. You would modify the baryosynthesis picture, you would modify the nucleosynthesis calculation, I'll get into that in more detail. A black hole, when evaporating, is going to produce any particles in nature, like gravitinos and neutrinos. It will remove monopoles or domain walls, sort of puncture domain walls. And later on, they could re-ionize the universe. So there are all sorts of physical effects that PBH will have on the early universe. And again, this is going to give constraints on how much the universe went into primordial black holes. The ones which are evaporating today, the 10 to the 15 grad ones, they are the ones which make most contact with direct observations. I've already referred to the fact that they make a cosmological gamma-ray background. They can produce galactic gamma-ray background. They can contribute to cosmic rays. They might, in principle, even be responsible for some of the gamma-ray bursts. But that's to say the very short gamma-ray bursts, not the larger ones, which are clearly astrophysical. They could be related to ultra-high-energy cosmic rays. And then the ones which are bigger than 10 to the 15 grams, they, of course, have not evaporated, but they can have lots of interesting gravitational effects. They could be cold dark matter candidates. They can have dynamical lensing effects, use gravitational waves, they can be relevant to large-scale structure, which is what my ash is interested in. And some people have even said that the black holes in galactic nuclei may have been formed from primordial black hole seeds. Is John Grazier is not here, is he? He's in camp. Okay, that was something he was thinking of. Anyway, so I've really just given you an overview of why primordial black holes are so interesting. And really, any one of these topics you could, one could give a lecture on. And they are reviewed in this paper. So what I want to do now, I want to just spend a little, have a little digression, in a way, for the next 5 minutes or so. I'm particularly excited about black holes and probes of higher dimensions. So I want to spend about 5 or 10 minutes talking about that. This isn't necessarily about primordial black holes, but I'm talking about mini black holes. And I should say, I'm not really an expert on making black holes in the Large Hadron Collider. The point is, you can make these mini black holes in various ways. You can make them in the early universe, I talked about, but also under certain circumstances, you'll form the cosmic rays and in particle accelerators. This is only if you have TV quantum gravity. But I did write a Scientific American article with Steve Giddings on this a few years ago, so that's why I got so interested in the topic. I think you probably all know this, the basic idea is that if you have these extra dimensions, everything hinges on what the scale, and the extra dimensions are wrapped up. The question is, what is the scale of the extra dimensions? And if the extra dimensions form a compact volume Vn, then there is a relationship between the Planck scale, and n is the number of extra dimensions, and the four-dimensional expression, which is the 10 to the minus 5 grams. So that's the standard formula. That's when you've got a compactified, when all the extra dimensions are compactified. If you're into brain cosmology, you have an extended dimension, but you have a warping factor. So it's in some sense the warped volume of the warp space, which is relevant. And in the standard model, of course, all the dimensions, extra dimensions, are something like the Planck scale. So this is something like the Planck volume. And so these two masses are the same. And that's the most natural scenario, and the one which probably most string theorists really, I don't know how many can hear on the string theorists, but probably that's the scenario most string theorists prefer. However, there are also these scenarios in which you can have the volume of the compactified space being much more than the Planck volume, because one or more of the extra dimensions is extended. And in this case, your quantum gravity effects come in at a much lower mass. And that's what the excitance is about. And under some circumstances, this energy can, if you're lucky, can go all the way down to the sort of TeV level, the sort of level which will be detected by LHC. And so the basic idea, this can happen either in cosmic rays or it can happen at the Large Hadron Collider. The basic idea is you've got your high energy particles, they get sufficiently close that they clash to form a black hole, and then the black hole is going to evaporate through the Hawking mechanism. And so the key point is that this makes it much easier to form a black hole. Because the point is, if in the normal scenario, you can never form a black hole smaller than the Planck mass, 10 to the minus 5 grams, which is 10 to the 19 GeV. And you can't form that, obviously, in the Large Hadron Collider. In these scenarios, where you've got extended extra dimensions, then it's much easier to form black holes. The relationship between the radius of the black hole and the mass is different. It goes like mass to the 1 over 1 plus n. Remember, n is the number of extra dimensions. So you don't need so much compression to form a black hole. You also incidentally modify the temperature. The temperature is pretty similar, but the lifetime of the black hole, for example, is modified a lot. So all your expressions for the lifetime of the black hole, indeed the critical mass of 10 to 15 grams, can all be modified if you're in the regime in which these extra dimensions are important. And so these are just some nice pictures from our Scientific American article, an artist's impression of what will happen when the LHC goes on. You form your black hole, it goes through various phases, and then it explodes. And in principle, is there anyone here who works on this, by the way? I have to be a little... Does anyone work on black holes in the LHC? Oh, good. Well, I mean bad, but I mean good in the sense I don't want to get them wrong.
Anybody here?
Anyway, not to worry. But I mean, the point is this, that if it's true, if there really are these, if you do have TeV quantum gravity, the LHC is going to shine like, they say, like a Christmas tree with these things. It will be noticed. And then if that happened, it would be really exciting, because you could, in some sense, by changing the energy, you could be probing different, you can probe these extra dimensions.
So just one point. So here you're assuming the black hole you form, but in the dimension that you form, it's going to be a stable black hole from the classical limit. That's something we don't know yet.
Well, it's assuming that because it's basically the equivalent of a Planck mass black hole, I'm assuming that it's going to be evaporating in the normal lifetime. You know, it will evaporate according to the Hawking process, and that's what's providing the signature.
Well, what I'm saying is, at the classical limit, you could have some instability of the black hole itself, so we know in four dimensions here it's stable, but we don't know in nine dimensions.
Oh, you mean you're talking about whether the black hole itself is going to be fragmented? What is the nature of the black hole? Because it's a high-dimensional black hole, and you're simply asking what is the high-dimensional black hole going to do in some classical sense apart from its Bronson effects? Yeah, I mean, I don't know that... I mean, I'm not really sure people have thought too much about that. I mean, normally what one is doing here, one is just assuming that they are radiating with a formula which is just modified by the extra dimensions. But there are all sorts of things to do with these high dimensional black holes about whether they, what their actual high dimensional structure is. And there's a lot of literature on that. The assumption here is that they do that, they just simply evaporate in a normal way.
So let me just ask, Luis, do you know what happens? Because you simulate black holes in extra dimensions. Are they classically stable or not?
Oh, it depends on the topology of things, how big these extra dimensions are, etc. So it could be some extra phenomenology before.
Right.
But as a practical matter, all we're doing is forming trapped surfaces. And since we haven't seen these things already, if we're going to see them at all, chances are they're going to be awfully close to the planet limit. So we're basically going to form instantaneously and then explode. So.
On the other hand, the Planck mass here is rather large. So, I mean,
you really got to push things. I mean, we're very lucky we'll see these.
Oh, yeah. This has to be very lucky. I mean, the chances, you know, we would be very lucky if it just happened that the LHC happened to get it to the world.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, I mean, the point is. It's something you can look for. Now, I want to give my own way of looking at this because I've been thinking quite a bit about these, and there'll be people here who know much more about higher dimensions than me, so I'm really looking forward for any comments. This is my way of looking at these higher dimensional black holes. This is just the ordinary length scale versus mass scale, and of course we all know that there's a sort of region which is excluded. By quantum effects, this is simply the quantum wavelength. That's the quantum domain. And we know in some sense, you know, space goes funny here, this is the sort of entanglement and EPR paradox. For example, of course, any particle, like the proton, that's its quantum wavelength, and this is the Large Hadron Collider gets down there, so that's got some interest in particle physicists, but as you know, a relativist is more interested in when the gravitational field becomes strong. And this is the Schwarzschild radius of the black hole of mass M. So in some sense, you have to be above that once you form a black hole. So there's a very stable configuration underneath it. And we know, of course, that time goes funny at this boundary. You know, in the obvious way that time freezes on the surface of the event. Now, here's the evaporating black hole, 10 to the 15 grams. And I was trying to understand exactly what these extra dimensions do. The first thing to point out is that the Planck scale, of course, is simply where these intersect, 10 to the minus 5 grams, 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. The other thing is, which I find not everybody knows, but this is called the generalized uncertainty principle, which is, in some sense, a natural extension of the uncertainty principle when you have to allow for the gravitational self-energy. And actually, what the generalized uncertainty principle is, it is essentially just this border. So it essentially just gives you a smooth transition from this boundary to this boundary. And one of the interesting aspects of this goes back to Adler and his colleagues, is that according to this, the black hole formula is modified. And so instead of going to infinity, it sort of, it has a maximum value, which is basically a more Planck temperature. And so that effect in itself is quite interesting because we want to know what is going to be the observational characteristics of black holes close to the Planck mass. But the other point, the main point I want to make is that, which I've already made, is that this formula, of course, assumes there are three spatial dimensions. If you have extra spatial dimensions, say n spatial dimensions, then the size of the black hole is related to the mass. It goes like m to the 1 over 1 plus n. That's just because gravity, instead of going like 1 over r squared, goes like 1 over r plus n. And so the normal, this is the black hole boundary when you've got three extra dimensions. But of course, what happens if we have four spatial dimensions? Then this becomes a half, and so we have a shallower slope, and now the Planck mass now is here. So you can see the mass has gone down, but the length has gone up. But of course, there may not be four dimensions, there may be five dimensions, and in that case, if you've got five dimensions, it goes like one over three, so it's shallower, and then if I've got six dimensions, it goes like 1 over 4. And so you can, and now you can see why with extra dimensions you are actually getting up to the Large Hadron scale. But of course, this is assuming that all the extra dimensions have the same scale, which to me is rather unlikely. I prefer a scenario where you sort of have a hierarchy of extra dimensions with different compactification scales. And I don't know if the string people agree with me, but it seems to be more natural that the scale, if you believe in extended dimensions, they're more likely to have a hierarchy of scales. Does that make sense?
I don't work on this myself, but I think most people would usually think about focus on one dimension being really big and the rest of them being uniform.
That's the brain cosmology picture, but...
Well, effectively, but yeah. Even in the larger, where you just have one compact configuration direction, which for some reason is much, much bigger than the others.
I mean, one dimension isn't good enough to get you into the LHC range anyway. You seem to need to have more than one dimension.
But it
sort of depends on where the assumption here is that this comes in when the black hole gets down to the scale of the first extended dimension. Anyway, I find this a really useful way of looking at things. But one thing I haven't realized until I drew this diagram is that actually, if you've got more than one extended dimension, the LHC is probing the higher dimensions. In other words, it will probe the sixth dimensions, not the fourth dimension, which is a bit odd. It's rather odd, and I'm still trying to work out what that really means. Anyway, so that's. I hope that's a useful way of. So to me, this is a nice way of sort of explaining why invoking these extra dimensions, these extended dimensions, will enable you to reduce these black holes in the LHC. Well, I'm not going to say anything more about that now, but this is... Lee isn't in the audience. Is Lee even here now? This bit was when Lee spoke, but he's not here, so I'm going to go straight.
There was a faculty meeting that lasted a very long time.
Never mind. Okay. If he comes in, I'll show him. Lee is very fond of making big universes out of black holes, and the point of my last transparency was just to say that most naturally... That happens, but they're five-dimensional.
But you can tell us, we can tell him about
it. Okay, well, now I'll tell it. I'll skip that out. But now, in sort of completing this little detour, let me just show this picture, because it sort of summarizes my philosophy about black holes. I'm sure you've seen this picture, the Ouroboros picture, which has got all the scales of structure from the height scale all the way around to the scale of the observable universe. Everybody knows about that. To me, it's a wonderful picture, and... It summarizes the triumph of physics, really, and the beauty and the unity of physics, all the links between the microscopic and the macroscopic domains. And to me, what's really interesting is that, of course, if you take this to the limits on the microscopic scale, you end up with end theory, and on the macroscopic side, you end up with the multiverse. And both of them seem to involve higher dimensions. You can see I'm very interested in higher dimensions. This is a bit bad, but I have to advertise my book on the universe, on the multiverse, universe on multiverse, which is now come out in paperback, and it's really cheap. But anyway.
So why do you say multiverse?
Sorry?
Exactly. Yeah. Why does multiverse mean higher dimensions?
Because it doesn't necessarily. Some of the multiverse scenarios involve brain cosmology. So one of the multiverse scenarios where you have brains... You imagine having a series of brains, rather like Neil, like, you know, finding brains. So that's a multiverse scenario where your multiverses are spread out in the fifth dimension. They don't all invoke extra dimensions. But it's just that happens to be what's something I'm interested in. But anyway, the reason I've done this is because I like putting black holes on this diagram according to their scale, the length scale. There's the Planck scale, the exploding black holes. These are the lunar black holes, which are useful for possible dark matter candidates. These are primordial. These are all primordial, on the right. Stellar black holes. The sort of, we know there's a million solar mass black hole in the center of the galaxy. There's the billion solar mass black hole in the center of the galaxy. And in some sense, the universe might be a big black hole. I'm actually now thinking in terms of the origin of the universe being a five-dimensional black hole, so not in the normal sense, but that's something I noticed. But to me, this is rather beautiful because it shows that the interest of the fundamental importance of black holes to all of physics on both the macroscopic and the microscopic domain. it shows that you've got this link. There's this wonderful symmetry between the macro, the connection between the macro and the micro domain, and it works for black holes as well. So, for example, if we go to the well, of course, there are extra dimensions. The point I was making is that this actually gets pushed down to 10 and 12 grams. But
what is the solution? Why is it a circle?
I was assuming people. What you do on this diagram, you simply plot all the objects that exist in the universe by scale. Okay, and each it corresponds to 60 decades of scale. So you go down from the Planck scale, 10 to the minus 33 centimeters, you go clockwise and you end up at 10 to the 27 centimeters, which is the current Hubble scale, the size of the universe. And then all these links represent the fact that there is the forces of nature link the micro and the macro domains. For example, the same force which determines the structure of a solid object like a mountain is the electric force which binds the electron to the nucleus. The same force which binds the nuclei together is the force which controls nuclear reactions in the sun and things. And the point about the head meeting the tail is that in the Big Bang picture, when you look to the largest distances, you're looking back to when the universe was very, very small. And so in some sense, the very large merges with the very small. But this is just, it's a sort of popular image, which is, I think Glashow first used it, but it's...
What is the gut theory?
What is the...
The gut.
Oh, grand unified grand theory. Unification. And the point about grand unified theory is grand unification occurs at very early phases in the history of the universe, but it's also possible that that's generating the fluctuations, or is associated with the fluctuations which associated with galaxies. I mean, you know, there are many different scenarios, but it's just... But the point is, it represents the links between the macroscopic and the microscopic domains. And to me, the link between the multiverse and the N theory is a particular example of that. In some sense, the culmination of that.
And where would gravity fit in that?
Well, the gravity, you see, I won't put gravity there explicitly, because in some sense, all of these things are determined by gravity. If you were going to put gravity anywhere, I mean, it's probably right at the top, in the sense that it's, if you're wanting the unification, which involves gravity, then it would be up at the top. But all of these things, the structure of everything on an astronomical scale is determined by gravity. And gravity doesn't directly come in on the right-hand side of this diagram until you get to the unification. So, sorry, I assume people were familiar with this sort of diagram. But anyway, to me, the point I was trying to make, I've lost my voice... Is that right? So this diagram at least is summarizes to me why black holes have such a hugely important contribution to all of physics. And this is contrasting the sort of astrophysical black holes and the sort of black holes that might form in the Large Hadron Collider. Now, so midway through my talk, it was really quite a big detour, it took longer than I intended. The huge potential mass range of primordial black holes makes them a powerful probe, both in macrophysics and microphysics. And in particular, they can provide unique information about higher dimensions. Now, this is not something we focus on in this long paper, but I wanted to, this is what I'm excited about right now, so that's why I'm talking about that. And I now want to get back to the question about the constraints on primordial black holes. And I'll go through this more quickly. I'm not going to go through the details, but if there are any particular aspects you want me to go into, I can do that, but I just want to give a broad overview. When you ask about primordial black hole formation, the most fundamental question you can ask is, what fraction of the universe goes into primordial black holes of mass m, say, at the time they form? And so to do that, you have to take the ratio of the black hole density to the CBRs, the cosmic background radiation. So you're taking the fraction of the black hole density to the background radiation density. And of course, in the early universe, most of the density is in the background radiation. Now, at the present epoch, if the black hole parameter and density parameter is only the PBH, the CBR density is roughly 10 to the minus 4. So that's the present ratio, which can be quite large. In principle, primordial black holes would have the critical density. However, as you go back in time, that ratio goes down like the scale factor. R is the cosmic scale factor. R naught is its present value. And the reason for that is that as you go back in time, the black hole density goes up like R to the minus 3, but the radiation density goes up like R to the minus 4. So the ratio goes like R, which means that this ratio must become very, very small. And for example, if the black hole forms at a time of 1 second, for example, this ratio beta, because beta is the fraction of the mass when the black hole forms, okay, then this is less than 10 to the minus 6 times omega pdh. Well, we don't know what omega pdh is, but it's got to be less than 1, so this is a very small fraction. Even the black holes forming at 1 second can only have a millionth, represents a millionth of the mass of the universe. Of course, there's a relationship between the time and the mass, which I showed you before, so I can express this in terms of the mass as well. And for example, the black holes that have a mass of 10 to 15 grams, this magic mass which is evaporating today, they could only represent at most 10 to the minus 18. So the point of that equation is it's saying that the fraction of the universe going into primordial black holes must have been tiny. It may have been zero, but it must have been tiny. But actually, that's what's expected, because in any of the scenarios for making them, the fraction is expected to be tiny. Yes?
So with all this, you assume that the black holes must be created after some sort of inflation, if there is inflation.
Well, yes, inflation is one particular scenario for making these, and if in the inflationary scenario, the black holes essentially are forming after inflation, because any black holes formed before inflation get diluted away, so you're interested only in the black holes that form after inflation. So inflation essentially gives you a lower limit to the mass of a black hole. Essentially, the horizon mass at the end of inflation is the lower limit. Well, what does this mean? Well, again, if we take the black holes which have not evaporated, the ones being 10 to 15 grams, we know they could in principle provide the cold dark matter, and we know what the cold dark matter density parameter is, 0.25, so that's the sort of upper limit we can put there. The ones that are evaporating today with a mass of 10 to 15 grams, they have they mustn't generate more than the extragalactic gamma ray background, the EGB, and I've already mentioned that's roughly 10 to the minus 8, I'm giving you a more precise figure. So this is even down to 10 to the minus 26. The ones which are actually less than 10 to the 15 grams, they're the ones which have evaporated, and they're going to do, as I mentioned before, all sorts of interesting things to the universe. They'll generate entropy, they'll change the photon to baryon ratio, they'll contribute to the gamma ray background, and they will also affect Big Bang nuclear synthesis. Now, throughout the history of this subject, people have therefore been very interested in what are the actual constraints on beta as a function of m. And the first diagram like this went back to Novikov et al. In 79, almost 40 years ago, oh no, 30 years ago. And so this is beta as against m, it was in, and that's the constraint that comes from Big Bang nuclear synthesis. This is the gamma ray background density I was given you, and this is the density. This is just equivalent to the limits I've just given before. That's the density parameter, and this is the gamma ray background limit. So really, that's just telling you what the Big Bang nuclear synthesis constraint is. And the point is, these numbers here are tiny. I seem to be making a lot of noise, but I think it's just this. Cold makes it easier, because it's being recorded, isn't it? Okay. Then I produced a record one in about 94, which looks much the same, except I've got this constraint associated with relics.
Can you go back to the previous?
Yeah.
So where does this, so these are just constraints on beta.
Yeah. This comes from the requirement that the relics today, the ones that are still there, must have more than critical density. This comes from the fact that the 10 to 15 grams must overuse the gamma ray background. This comes from the fact you mustn't mess up Big Bang nuclear synthesis, and this comes from the fact you mustn't produce too many photons, because the photon baryon ratio gets too large. In the next picture, it's much the same, I've just done all the side calculations, and this is this is based on the fact that if the relics, if Hawking evaporation leads to Planck-Nash relics, they will actually contribute to the dark mass.
Why would you guys have nucleus physicists?
Well, the problem is that the black holes which evaporate in about 1 second, between, you know, 1 to 100 seconds, they modify the nuclear synthesis picture. So the Big Bang nuclear synthesis picture works really well, and we don't want to mess it up.
Those which are evaporating just about at the time of the nuclear.
The mass range here, which is about 10 to the 10th grams, that's the mass range such that they evaporate at nuclear synthesis. I'm going to skip some of these things. I'll skip this too. This is just saying how. Well, all right, I'll put it now, so I might as well. But the point is that once you've got a constraint on beta, you can constrain any cosmological model which predicts a certain fraction of the universe collapsing. So, for example, I mentioned that the best way of making black holes is from density perturbations. And if I take, if the amplitude horizon epoch fluctuation on the mass scale n is epsilon m, then it's easy to show that with Gaussian fluctuations, the fraction of the universe collapsing has this sort of exponential dependence. I won't go into that, it's because it's a long time ago. But so I can convert my beta m diagram into an epsilon m diagram. So that's this is the amplitude of the density fluctuation at the horizon epoch on a mass scale m. And so those beta n constraints can be turned into epsilon n constraints using that. Now, on the large scales, we know from COBE, or more recently from WMAP, that we know what the amplitude of the horizon scale fluctuation is today. It's very small, it's 10 to the minus 5 or something. If we want to make primordial black holes, we have to have much higher fluctuations of order something like 10%. So the sort of fluctuations we know exist today are not big enough. The only way you can get primordial black holes forming is if you have what we call a blue spectrum. That's to say we have larger amplitudes on smaller scales. So this is just giving you the sort of scenarios where you could form primordial black holes from the inhomogeneities. But the point of this diagram is that you can read it in another way. You can put constraints on precisely how blue the spectrum must be. There's a relationship between this is the lower limit is essentially the end of inflation. This relates to your question. But anyway, let me. So really, there's been a lot of interest in those beta n constraints. Once you've got the beta n constraints, you can apply all sorts of apply them to all sorts of contexts. But this, so I wanted to get the most up to date and comprehensive constraints one could. And so in this paper with the Japanese, this is again, oh, it's gone off the shore. This is the beta diagram. This is beta on the y-axis and log m again on the x-axis. And essentially, this shows the huge number of effects which enable you to constrain the value of beta. But the most important thing to bear in mind is that these numbers here are time. You know, we're going all the way down to 10 to the minus 30. The mass range here is going all the way from 10 to the 9th grams to 10 to the 17th grams. So basically, this is the evaporating PDH range. And essentially, the most important constraints are the constraints associated with cosmological nucleosynthesis and the gamma ray background. But all the effects are interesting, and essentially what we do in the paper, we go through all of these constraints and find what they are. Now, actually, it's also interesting to ask about the black holes which are in a wider mass range, which don't evaporate, with the ones which are large enough not to evaporate. So this diagram goes all the way down from the Planck mass, normal Planck mass, 10 to the minus 5 grams, all the way up to 10 to the 50 grams, which is sort of comparable to the scale of the universe. And so these constraints here are just the ones in the middle here. These are constraints associated with Planck mass relics, and these are constraints associated with a variety of astrophysical, you know, lensing and dynamical effects on larger mass. I'll say something about. Now, obviously, there's a huge amount to talk about there, and I'm not going to overwhelm you by going through all the details. So I thought I've got about 5 minutes left, so I'll just go through one or two of the most important ones, okay? And if there's any one of these effects you want to ask me about, of course I can do that. So I'm going to be skipping through quite a lot of slides because I knew I was going to do that, but just so you can ask me about them if you're interested. I'm not going to show you. That's just the. Let me just say something about the evaporation process itself. This is the standard. This is just doing things a little bit more precisely. This is the standard temperature for the black hole as a function of mass. And you can predict, it's not really black body, it's actually grey body, it depends on the spin of the particle. So you can ask where the energy peaks, so the numerical factors. But the important thing is the mass loss comes from, you simply take the black body formula, but it depends on the number of species which you can actually emit. Because basically a black hole will emit any particle whose rest mass is less than its temperature. And so one's interested in how this parameter F evolves. It's defined to be one where you're only emitting massless particles, but essentially as the black hole mass goes up, as the black hole temperature goes up, the number of species climbs, and when you get to the quark-hadron phase transition, the QCD phase transition, something very dramatic happens. You start generating quark and gluons, which are emitted like jets, so there's a big increase in the value of this F, the number of species which is being produced. And so, if you're doing this calculation precisely, you have to allow for that. It doesn't make too much difference. For example, the mass of the black hole evaporating today, instead of being 10 to the 15 grams, turns out to be 5.1 times 10 to the 14 grams. But we just wanted to do the calculations more precisely. But one thing which isn't always appreciated is that the features of black hole evaporation change very dramatically when you reach the QCD temperature, which is about 200 to 300 MeV. Up until then, you are just emitting the fundamental particles with a black body spectrum. But when you get to this temperature, you start producing the quark and gluon jets, which then decay into the stable hadrons, which may then decay over a longer time scale. So the spectrum is completely different. So this, for example, is the instantaneous emission from a 1 GeV black hole. The direct thermal emission, which Hawking talked about, is just this little bit at the top. But what is happening is that these particles, your quark and gluons, are fragmenting into a lower energy. So you have a sort of Bremsstrahlung tail, and this is associated with the decay of photons and pions and things. So it's a very different picture. And so what we wanted to do was we wanted to be able to actually see what difference this made to all the astrophysical and cosmological effects of the early universe. There's also lots of interesting things to do with when the black hole evaporates. Do the particles form a photosphere? And I'm going to cut short this discussion. It was originally claimed they would form a photosphere through QED interactions, but recently Jane McGibbon and Don Page and myself have produced a long paper arguing that you don't get a photosphere. So, and that makes quite a difference to the detectability of black hole explosions. Missing out this. So now, and so then what you can do is you can simply, we assume for these limits that we've got a monochromatic mass spectrum, mass function, and you can simply ask, what is the, it's done with a numerical code called the Pythia code, and you have your primary emission, your secondary emission, and part of the problem here is you've got to look very carefully at the nature of the secondary emission. And I won't go through the details, but it's all in the program. So if I take a black hole of a given mass, this is the black holes of given temperatures from 1 GeV to 30 MeV, I can write down what the spectrum, energy spectrum of the particles is. Some of it comes from the primary emission, it comes from some comes from the secondary emission. We get to lower diagrams. Now, we started off just looking at Big Bang nucleosynthesis. And this subject actually has a long history. I'm not going to go through the history in detail, I've got to go through the transparency, but basically there are different effects. All was studied, this is way back in the 70s, that neutrinos from PBHs affect the neutron-proton freeze-out ratio. The photons which are ejected from evaporating black holes affect the photon-to-baryon ratio. The nucleons which are injected, protons and antiprotons, they affect the nucleosynthesis process itself directly. And then photons produced later on will dissociate neutrons. And all of these things are associated with effects. I'm not going to go through the details of all this. This is just showing how the code works. And then, of course, we have to have certain abundance constraints. I just want to show you what the limits are. So, obviously, if you want to read the details, you can see it in the paper. But these are the constraints on beta as a function of m, which come from nucleosynthesis. And I'm just going to show you how they arise. If you have, it's funny, it doesn't get to the left-hand side of the screen for some reason. Oh, maybe I move this.
You have to hold it.
It doesn't matter. Basically, the black holes, which are smaller than 10 to the 9th grams, they evaporate too early to do anything. The ones which evaporate between 10 to the minus 2 and 100 seconds, they've got a mass range 10 to the 9th to 10 to the 10th. Basically, what they do, the hadrons which are produced, because these are the small black holes which are emitting hadrons through the quark jets and gluon jets, they actually are going to increase and change the neutron proton freeze out ratio, which of course affects the helium abundance. I'm assuming, are people familiar with the standard Big Bang picture here? Is that a fair assumption? The ones which are evaporate between 100 and 10 to the 7 seconds, they're 10 to the 10th to 10 to the 12th grams. The hadrons now, they actually break up helium and they increase the deuterium and the lithium 6. The ones which are even bigger, between say 10 to the 12th and 10 to the 13 grams, they're evaporating later, between 10 to the 7th and 10 to the 12 seconds. The photons then start breaking up the things like the helium and reducing deuterium and helium-3. So essentially, this is where all our constraints come from. Above 10 to the 13 grams, you essentially don't have any effect. So the point is that these are the constraints you get over this mass range 10 to the 9 to 10 to the 13 grams from nucleosynthesis. And those are the most interesting limits.
What is this a little bit about the cutoff?
Well, this is just a technicality about why this does not cut off. It doesn't cut off completely because, in fact, it cuts off slowly because even the bigger ones, some fraction of their mass will end up in smaller mass black holes. So this is just explaining why it doesn't cut off completely, but it has a power or enter the center's power.
Does this mean something about how they're formed?
No. This is just a statement that when it evaporates, even the one which initially has a mass bigger than 10 to the 30 grams, some fraction of it will end up in a smaller mass black hole before it evaporates.
Yes.
And therefore, some fraction of it... So some fraction of it will therefore be in this mass range.
If it's 10 to the 16 grams or something, that'll...
No, it's because it's such a... It's a high, it's a steep power. So 10 to the 16, it effectively cuts off a bit above 10 to the 13. So anyway, there is this... This is what this constraint looks like. I'm only going to talk about the rate constraint. So this is our constraint, which comes from nucleosynthesis. Now, the other one is to do with the diffuse gamma ray background. This is the only other one I'm going to do in any detail. I told you that historically, that the first constraint of these objects came from the 10 to the 15 gram black holes came from the gamma ray background. You remember that was the constraint. Omega must be less than 10 to the minus 8. Well, you can do the calculation more precisely. You take various masses for your black hole, you integrate over time, bearing in mind that the radiation has to be redshifted, and then you can you get constraints on the fraction of the universe as a function of m. It obviously bottoms out at 10 to the 5th, roughly, well, it's 5 times 10 to the 14 grams. And that is the constraint you get merely from the requirement that you must overproduce the gamma ray background. But the gamma ray background, of course, is now measured much more precisely, and it covers a range of energies which corresponds to a range of masses. So now we've got this this is what the actual constraint is. You can analytically write down these sort of power laws. But the actual omega you get is something like 5 times 10 to the minus 10. You remember that it was the Hawking result all those years ago was 10 to the minus 8. So basically, in the intervening 30 years, it gets a bit stronger. So there is the these are the constraints now which come from the gamma ray background, and these are the constraints that come from the Big Bang nuclear synthesis. Now, there are lots of other effects to get this, but I just want to, I'm just going to go through these very quickly in 1 minute, essentially. If you were interested in any particular constraints, you can ask me, or you can look at the paper. First of all, I've only talked about the extragalactic gamma ray background. There is also a galactic gamma ray background, and that also places a constraint, and that's shown by that little dotted line there. It's a little bit weaker than the galactic, extragalactic one. Cosmic rays, one of the questions is whether some of the proton, antiprotons, and positrons in cosmic rays come from primordial black holes. And we don't know, but I'm not putting a constraint there because it's very model dependent. There are extragalactic cosmic rays, the ones which produce at an earlier epoch, and that they correspond to a blue region. Blue just means that we calculated the limit for the first time. Some of these are just new. Obviously, people are interested in black hole explosions, but again, there's no definite evidence for that, so I'm not putting a constraint. There were also produced neutrinos. The neutrinos from primordial black holes would have been detected, for example, by candy. So you get this constraint here. I mean, the interesting thing is that the red ones and the dominant ones. If you've got if the dark matter is supersymmetric particles, you could have LSP relics, and those relics would also be produced by the primordial black hole evaporations, and you've got a constraint like that. All of these constraints depend on parameters, but too bothered. The primordial black holes, they will generate photons which will distort the spectrum of the microwave background. And that corresponds to a constraint that looks something like that. Again, in the calculation if anyone's interested, but the point is it's actually well above the nuclear synthesis limit. If you want the dark mass to be in the form of these large black holes, it can have it like that. But you get a strong constraint simply from requiring the density parameter does not exceed, say, 0.25, which is the density parameter of cold dark matter. That's a limit, looks like that. A rather remarkable result, which I didn't anticipate, was it turns out that if the black holes are in some mass range, the radiation will actually erase small-scale anisotropies. This was already known from people who put constraints on decaying particle models. And this turns out to be the strongest constraint of all. And I put it dotted because I couldn't quite believe it at first, but I think it's probably correct. So we get a very strong constraint on primordial black holes in the range here, which is even stronger than the gamma ray limit, simply because they must not eradicate the small-scale anisotropies of the CMB, which are already observed by WMAP. And then that's only potential. So that really summarizes all the limits. And I'm not going to go through all those. So just close your eyes. I'm going to go through the calculations. This is just in case you were going to ask me questions. I'm not going to do this. I've run out of time. But if you want to ask me on that, anything you can. Okay, you can open them up again now. So there's that summary again. And as I said, I've only gone through the red ones in detail because they're the more interesting ones. I do though just want to finish off talking about the constraints on the black holes which are large enough not to evaporate, because to the astronomers that's actually often the more interesting ones. So now I'm talking about black holes which are bigger than 10 to 15 grams. They therefore could be contribute to the cold dark mass. I defined a ratio F, which is simply the density parameter of the PBHs over the cold dark matter density parameter, which is something like 0.25. It's just related, it's just 4 times omega PBH. That's related to beta, as I've defined it for, with an n to the minus a half factor. But for this discussion, it's more interesting to think in terms of f. And so what I'm now going to do, I'm going to write down the limits on f as a function of mass. So for people who are interested in astrophysical size black holes, this is the more interesting section. And there are very interesting effects that come from lensing of limits, and these are the ones shown in red. These, for example, are the famous microlensing limits that come from the Matthew survey. You look at the Large Magellanic Cloud, and you look at the stars in our halo, the dark objects in our halo, which cause them to flicker. And these are the well-known constraints, which basically anything above the red line is excluded. So you're basically excluding things in the range. It's a wide range from something like 10 to the minus 6 to 37 masses. Femto lensing of gamma ray bursts. When you look at gamma ray bursts, it's rather remarkable that there's a very small range, 10 to the minus 16 to 10 to the minus 13 solar masses. If there were PBHs in that range, they would, which wouldn't have evaporated, they're all about 10 to the 15 grams, they would produce femto lensing of gamma ray bursts, and that's that limit there. The micro lensing of quasars comes in the range 10 to the minus 3 to 60 solar masses, so that's that range there. And the mini-lensing of compact radio sources, mini-lensing because it's milli-arc seconds rather than micro-arc seconds, this puts a constraint on 10 to the 6 to 10 to the 8, so that's that there. So those are the regions that are excluded by lensing. There are then all sorts of limits on dynamical limits, which I put in green here. And this is the disruption of wide binaries. Again, I'm just giving you the results. Obviously, if you want to read how you get those forms, there are all the papers and references that are given. But that's the wide binary, constraining things in the range, basically 500 to 10 to the 8th solar masses. Disruption of globular clusters. If our halo was made up of these primordial black holes, they would disrupt globular clusters if you were above this green dotted line. The heating of the galactic disk excludes a line like this. And then dynamical friction, if you had really large primordial black holes, so the million solar mass objects in the halo, they get dragged into the center of the galaxy by dynamical friction, and that would be consistent with observation. So this is the DF line, which looks like that. And I wanted to get to the last one because this is your constraint, of course, a very interesting constraint, that if you had sufficiently large primordial black holes, merely the statistical fluctuations, the Prandtl fluctuations in their number density, would produce enormously large scale perturbations. In particular, this constraint is associated with the Lyman alpha clouds. And the Prandtl fluctuations would generate essentially Lyman alpha clouds too many or too early, however you want to look at it. And this was a very nice paper. Have I got the year? I just guessed it's probably.
I don't remember.
But anyway, it was so far away that neither of us can remember, but it was probably 2007. But it's.
I think it's 2003, or
2003. Time goes fast now, but anyway. But anyway, this is just our interpretation. I don't know if you agree with it, but we sort of produced an analytic formula. You did a very nice numerical calculation, but I think that's what it corresponds to. And that's the limit down there. Well, that's all I want to say. So I want to, that's the formula anyway, it's a simple formula, f less than m over 10 to the fourth minus 1. Well, that's all I want to say. So let me just finish up with the conclusions. This is the summary diagram, which shows all of these constraints. And so the key point is that primordial black holes, really, the constraints go over 60 mass decades, all the way from the Planck maps, really, to almost the scale of the observable universe. And they provide a unique probe of inflation, dust phases, cosmic strings, the main walls, primordial inhomogeneity, all those things which I talked about earlier, which are actually generate primordial black holes. And in particular, I focused on their constraints on extra dimension, because that's what I'm most excited about now. But I'll finish there. Thank you. Sorry, I'm slightly off.
Thank you very much.
these new results didn't change the bound on the spectral index.
Well, I mean, the point is that with these constraints, I mean, you do change the bounds, but I mean, the point is that the, well, I have to go back to the original diagram here. Yes, I mean, basically, once you've got a diagram like that, I can then use it to constrain any model for the formation. In particular, I can use it to constrain the spectral index. Now, it's not so much different from the previous diagram. I mean, because I had my constraints before, if you remember, were basically something like this. It just wasn't quite as low and wasn't so fine detail. But because the spectral index has a sort of an exponential dependence, there is an exponential dependence of the p beta in terms of fluctuation amplitude, it doesn't make so much difference to the actual limit on the spectral index itself. I would say, though, that actually I think the blue spectrum scenario is probably rather unlikely now, and I think the most natural way of getting primordial black holes is to have some feature. I showed those power law spectra which have a unique value of n. I think that's really rather unlikely, both in terms of models and in terms of the data, but if you really want primordial black holes, it's far more natural to say that there is some feature in the power spectrum, or that there is some phase transition at a particular epoch which is going to produce primordial black holes with a fairly narrow mass range. That's what, in these constraints, we're always assuming we've got a monochromatic mass range. So I'm saying, what's the constraint on beta as a function of a particular mass? Now, obviously, if I have an extended spectrum, then that's giving me more information because I can relate beta at one mass to beta at another mass. But I think the most natural, the point is, for example, if I want to have the dark mass to be in primordial black holes, say in solar mass primordial black holes, I can't do that if I have an extended spectrum which goes all the way down to 10 to 15 rands, because there I've got really strong constraints. So it's actually the most natural thing, if you want to have a lot of primordial black holes, is to simply say I don't extend into this mass range at all. And there are plenty of ways in which I can reduce a spike in a spectrum, to make primordial black holes, or even just say I've got a phase transition which makes the equation stay soft. There was a time when people were interested in producing the quark-hadron phase transition, producing something like Jupiter mass black holes, because you remember there was a time when it looked as though the microlensing observations suggested that the dark mass was in these sort of Jupiter mass type objects, half solar mass type objects or something. And people thought, they must be primordial black holes, because that's the natural mass scale that forms the quark-hadron phase transition. Well, people don't believe the microlensing results now indicate that, but it's an example of how you can naturally produce a primordial black hole without invoking a sort of extended mass function. Later on, if there's anyone here who's an expert on extra dimensions, I would be very interested in getting any feedback about that, and I don't know who are the people who work on things like that, but I'd be keen to, because that's what I'm most excited on at the moment. So.
You're going to find somebody. We're going to find somebody.
You'll find somebody, thank you, yeah.
So we're going to take Bernard to dinner at around 6:30 tonight, if that's fine with you.
Oh, yes, that's fine, thank you, yes.
Good. So if there is no more questions, any burning question left, then... Oh, okay, David.
I would like to know if the decay of primordial black hole being deformed in photosynthesis could have a positive influence on the density of lithium 6 and lithium 7
You mean, can it solve? Can it actually solve any of these problems? Some people have argued, in this paper, we do not try and use primordial black holes to positively explain any of the anomalies in the Big Bang nucleosynthesis. We just take the view that the Big Bang nucleosynthesis picture works pretty well, and that therefore we don't want to mess it up. Now, let me just think. There have historically certainly been attempts to explain some anomalies in terms of either primordial black holes or some other astrophysical effect. I'm not aware of anything in recent years, certainly not which involves primordial black holes, because all of the various anomalies, and obviously when you talk about the lithium abundances, lithium 6 and lithium 7 ratio, there are all sorts of historical problems on precisely what that ratio is and whether there are. I mean, although broadly speaking, the Big Bang picture explains the light elements abundances very nicely, there are some specific anomalies when you look in detail, mostly I think associated with lithium and people. But historically, those anomalies are varied, so I'm not quite sure what the latest status is. And we've always used the most conservative limits on these abundances in this paper to get constraints on beta M. So I'm not sure of any recent paper in the last few years, but maybe you are. I mean, maybe you're working on this or something. So, I mean, but it could be there's someone here who's you know, better informed about that than me. But I'm not aware of any recent work trying to relate nucleosynthesis anomalies with primordial black hole evaporations.
In case no more questions, thank Bernard again.